they just march ahead with marginalizing women. And how many times, whether it's Algeria or Palestine, time after time, it's about time that we learn that no, not I'm not prepared to be accommodating. We women defend the rights of Arab men time and time again, only to see them not have our backs and defend women's rights and gender rights. It seems to me that what we've been in the broader Arab intellectual context is the last, as we transition to what clearly all over the Arab world is this move to, if you open up for democratization, people are veering toward Islamiyin, toward Islamism, as if sort of moving out of the Nahda period, the last of the Nahda rationalism and the Nahda also anti-colonialism, and yet paradoxically European-centered kind of ideology and kind of thinking, even with the mid-century revolution. So I sort of almost wonder if this is a part of the global turn toward fundamentalism and extremism. There also may be something, I'm trying to acknowledge here that there may be something deeply decolonial in it, in reaching for indigenous belief systems, but we have to transcend out of it, and I, don't know if I will live long enough to see that next cycle, to something that opens up this extremely narrow and crushing form of Islam that really grew under anti-colonial movements and is a reaction to them.
Kate Raphael interviewed Syrian exiles Afra Jalabi and Moja Kaf in December 2024, days after the fall of Assad's regime. You'll find links to both parts of this interview, plus our 2012 interview with the same women, through our website, wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Jackson Reffitt, and I reported the authorities on my dad's, far-right behavior leading up to January 6th, and even though his violent actions were absolutely destroyed my family, now he's pardoned, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in hiding.
As President Trump defends his sweeping pardons for the January 6th insurrectionists, we'll speak with a young man who fears for his life after Trump pardoned his father, who'd been sentenced to over 7 years in prison. We'll also look at Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization while freezing communications by many federal health agencies and canceling upcoming meetings of the National Institutes of Health and other agencies. Then to the occupied territories, while ceasefires largely holding in Gaza, Israel's intensifying attacks on the West Bank. The Israeli military has killed at least 13 people in Jenin in recent days, while Israeli settlers carry out a new wave of attacks.
What they failed to achieve in Gaza, they are trying to make up for here in Jenin. Not only in Jenin. Jenin is the center of resistance and fighting. If they finish the resistance in Jenin, they will finish it in all of the West Bank.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's expanded his crackdown on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, revoking a 60-year-old executive order signed by then-President Lyndon B. Johnson, banning hiring discrimination by federal contractors. On Wednesday, the Trump administration also ordered federal employees to report on their colleagues who refused to comply with orders to purge DEI initiatives, threatening adverse consequences for workers who fail to report their co-workers. This comes a day after the Trump administration placed employees in any federal DEI offices on immediate administrative leave. The Justice Department's ordered a freeze on all new cases in its Civil Rights Division. Ongoing cases, including police reform agreements in major cities, will be subject to the discretion of judges. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law called it an unprecedented move that, quote, should make Americans both angry and deeply worried, unquote. Separately, the Justice Department has ordered federal officials to prosecute state and local officials who resist the Trump administration's plans for mass deportations. In related news, the ACLU is suing the Trump administration on behalf of Make the Road New York over its plan to expand fast-track deportations while denying due legal process. The expedited deportation policy targets immigrants who cannot prove they've been in the U.S. continuously for at least 2 years. In more immigration news, both houses of Congress have now passed the final version of the Laken Riley Act, which requires federal immigration authorities to detain undocumented immigrants arrested for certain nonviolent crimes. The bill now goes to the White House, where it's set to be signed as Trump's first law. This comes as the Pentagon says it'll deploy another 1,500 active duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. President Trump signed executive orders rolling back federal subsidies for the Affordable Care Act and threatening the health care of tens of millions of people. One order reverses Biden-era efforts to lower the cost of prescription drugs for Medicare and Medicaid recipients. Another order shortens the open enrollment period to purchase health insurance. Yet another executive order rolls back a Biden-era program that made more parents with young children eligible for Medicaid. Trump's also phasing out a program that lowered the cost of health insurance premiums for lower-income families. Meanwhile, Trump has canceled scientific gatherings and panels across federal health agencies and directed all employees at the Health and Human Services Department to halt external communications, including public health advice on diseases like COVID-19, influenza, and norovirus. We'll have more on this after headlines. In more related news, a government website set up in 2022 offering information on abortion access and rights has been taken offline. ReproductiveRights.gov has gone dark since at least Monday, the day of Trump's inauguration. On Wednesday, Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee grilled Budget Office nominee Russell Vogt on Trump's plans to cut Medicaid and federal nutrition assistance in order to offer more tax cuts to the wealthy. In a tense exchange with Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, Vogt touted welfare work requirement policies and the Republican-backed Clinton-era welfare reform that ended up doubling extreme poverty and depriving those most in need of essential government support.
It led to caseload reductions, people getting off of welfare, going back into the workforce. And we think that that type of thinking should be applied to other federal programs. And it's informed not only Medicaid, but the other programs to be able to encourage people to get back into the workforce, increase labor force participation, and give people, again, the dignity of work.
And you believe cutting off health care encourages people to work when they need to get better health in order to work? It doesn't make any sense.
Again,
and it's been a failed experiment.
OMB chief nominee Russell Vogt co-authored the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, the far-right blueprint to radically reshape federal agencies. President Trump has named former fast food CEO and failed 2017 Labor Secretary nominee Andrew Puzder to be ambassador to the European Union. Puzder was forced to withdraw from consideration as Labor Secretary in Trump's first cabinet amidst allegations of domestic violence and reports of widespread sexual harassment and labor and safety violations at his chain restaurants Carl's Jr. and Hardee's. Humanitarian aid groups in Gaza report more than 3,200 aid trucks have entered the Palestinian territory in the first 4 days since the ceasefire agreement took effect. Civil defense workers have recovered the bodies of 162 people trapped under the rubble of destroyed homes and businesses and are working to uncover thousands more. Palestinian officials report Israel dropped around 100,000 metric tons of explosives on Gaza during its 15-month assault, destroying 88% of Gaza's infrastructure. About 20,000 children became orphans, losing one or both parents. More than 40% of families in Gaza are taking care of children who are not their own. On Wednesday, displaced Palestinian families returned to Gaza City, many for the first time in months to find a ruined wasteland.
Our families will return from the south to their blessed land of Gaza City. However, they will not find their homes as they were destroyed by the Zionist occupation. They will find tents that we set up to meet their simplest needs. These tents will welcome the displaced families, hoping to heal some of their pain after seeing their destroyed homes that have now turned into rubble, which used to be filled with families.
In the occupied West Bank, residents of the Jenin refugee camp are reporting constant gunfire and explosions as Israel's deadly raid enters its third day. Doctors and eyewitnesses say Israeli soldiers are besieging two hospitals with medical teams coming under fire and ambulance crews barred from reaching the dead and wounded. Some 600 medical workers and patients are sheltering inside Jenin's Khalil Suleiman governmental hospital with dwindling supplies of food and water. The hospital's director reports three doctors and two nurses were shot on the road leading to the hospital this week. Elsewhere, two Palestinians were killed during an Israeli raid on the town of Berkin outside Jenin. Residents say Israeli troops have begun forcing families to leave their homes as part of a campaign to break Palestinian resistance.
What they failed to achieve in Gaza, they are trying to make up for here in Jenin. Not only in Jenin. Jenin is the center of resistance and fighting. If they finish the resistance in Jenin, they will finish it in all of the West Bank.
Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said Wednesday, the West Bank military operation dubbed Iron Wall represents a shift in security strategy that took lessons from the Gaza campaign. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that Israeli leaders have turned their attention from Gaza to the West Bank, hoping to annex the territory once and for all. Guterres spoke Wednesday at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
Israel, feeling emboldened by the military successes that it has had, to think that this is the moment to do the annexation of the West Bank. To keep the Gaza in a kind of a limbo situation with an unclear form of governance. It is clear for me that Israel is not fundamentally interested in Gaza, it's fundamentally interested in the West Bank.
President Trump has redesignated Yemen's Houthi movement as a terrorist organization. The move reverses Biden's removal of the terrorist label in February 2021 and reinstates the label first imposed by Trump's then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as the first Trump administration was preparing to leave office. Houthi fighters have attacked cargo ships in the Red Sea and fired projectiles at Israel amidst Israel's war on Gaza. As in 2021, aid groups warn the U.S. terrorist designation could increase the humanitarian crises of hunger and illness in Yemen. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, thousands more people have been displaced in recent days after M23 rebels seized the key eastern town of Minova, a main supply route for Goma, the capital of North Kivu province.
I lived in Minova. When we were told the enemies were approaching, my sister and I fled to Nzulu on foot last Friday. Now the enemy is in Bugulube, and we are fleeing without knowing where we are going, as if we have nowhere to return. Look, my older sister gave birth yesterday. She has a baby, and we don't know what to do.
Aid groups are warning of a deepening humanitarian crisis in eastern Congo as intensified fighting has displaced nearly a quarter of a million people since just the start of the year, half of them children. In related news, Belgium appointed a judge this week to investigate a criminal complaint brought last month by the DRC against Apple in France and Belgium, accusing the tech giant of using conflict minerals in their supply chains. Over 200 armed groups, including the Rwanda-based M23, have been engaged in a protracted violent conflict for control over mines where minerals including tin, tungsten, and tantalum are extracted. In Southern California, another 31,000 people have received mandatory evacuation orders as a new wildfire north of Los Angeles broke out and quickly scorched through 10,000 acres Wednesday. Rights groups are urging authorities to completely evacuate the Pitches Detention Center, which houses some 4,700 prisoners and is in the evacuation zone for the Hughes Fire. Meanwhile, health experts are warning Los Angeles Angelenos who lost their homes in the Eaton and Palisades fires to use extra precautions if returning to retrieve personal items amidst the rubble, as toxic chemicals, including lead, asbestos, and arsenic, are likely present in the ashes. Air quality data shows atmospheric concentrations of lead, which is a neurotoxin, hit 100 times average levels in Los Angeles during the worst of the wildfires. And in the Netherlands, climate activists with Greenpeace celebrated Wednesday after a judge ordered the Dutch government to dramatically cut nitrogen emissions by 2030. Greenpeace successfully argued the Dutch government failed to uphold European regulations limiting nitrogen oxide emissions due to farms, fertilizer, and automobiles.
It's definitely a victory after decades of inaction. I think this verdict really shows that the plans of previous cabinets are not adequate, and now they actually have to come up with a plan. And I think that's very necessary given the current state of nature.
The move is expected to face intense backlash from right-wing parties that form the Netherlands' current ruling coalition and farmers who fear having to reduce their livestock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Public health advocates across the globe are expressing alarm after President Trump ordered the United States to withdraw from the UN's World Health Organization. The U.S. is the biggest financial backer of the WHO, contributing about 18% of the agency's budget. Trump's decision puts numerous programs at risk, including efforts to tackle tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS. On Monday evening, Trump signed an executive order declaring the U.S. would leave the Global Health Agency.
So we paid $500 million to World Health when I was here, and I terminated it. China, with 1.4 billion people, we have 350. Nobody knows what we have because so many people came in illegally, but let's say we have 325. They had 1.4 billion. They were paying 39 million. We were paying 500 million. It seemed a little unfair to me.
Speaking in Geneva, WHO spokesperson Tarek Yasarevich responded to Trump's decision.
The World Health Organization regrets the announcement that the United States of America intends to withdraw from the organization. WHO plays a crucial role in protecting the health and security of the world's people, including Americans, by addressing the root causes of disease, building stronger health systems, and detecting, preventing, and responding to health emergencies, including disease outbreaks, and often in dangerous places where others cannot go.
In addition to pulling out of the World Health Organization, the Trump administration has frozen communications by many federal health agencies, including public health updates, and canceled upcoming meetings of the National Institutes of Health and other agencies. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Lawrence Gostin, professor of global health law at Georgetown University and director of the WHO Collaborating Center on Public Health Law and Human Rights. His piece in the Washington Post is headlined, "Trump is withdrawing from the WHO. That's a grave mistake." Dr. Gostin is also the author of several books, including Global Health Security, A Blueprint for the Future. Dr. Gaston, welcome back to Democracy Now! A number of issues to discuss here, a full frontal attack on the scientific medical establishment. Let's start with the organization that Trump is pulling out of, that the U.S. helped to found, the World Health Organization, the significance of this.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me back. Taking all of this together, it really is an attack on science, public health and public health institutions. The Trump administration and President Trump signed a blizzard of executive orders, and many of them were deeply consequential about energy and also about immigration. But flying under the radar, I thought, was the most momentous decision, really cataclysmic decision, which is to withdraw from the World Health Organization. We started the World Health Organization in 1948, and for over 75 years, WHO has kept the world and America safer and healthier, and we've been its most influential and biggest funder. I couldn't imagine a world without WHO, and President Trump is really hollowing out that organization. And I believe it's a grave mistake also for American national interests and our national security.
Professor Gaston, actually, could you elaborate on that? What risk does it present to the U.S. itself? It would obviously be catastrophic for global public health. But what does the U.S. rely on the WHO for?
Well, we rely on the WHO for so many things that we never even realize as a population. First of all, and most immediate, is that WHO has a global response capacity. And so wherever there's a hot spot in the world, whether it's polio in Gaza or Ebola in West Africa or Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you name it. The WHO is there early, and they put out fires before they come to America. And remember, we're not immune. You can't close the border to a pathogen the way that the president appears to think that he can close it to immigration. Germs don't know any boundaries. The other thing I want to mention, as I think is even more important, is that WHO has a vast network of laboratories, scientists, and public health agencies that report on data. Our pharmaceutical companies, our public health agencies like CDC and NIH rely on that data to develop the vaccines and treatments that we need when the next health emergency hits. Americans are used to being at the front of the line when it comes to vaccines and treatments, with Africa and others at the back. We might find ourselves near the back of the line next time because we're not going to have access to those vital pieces of information like pathogen samples or genomic sequencing data or the emergence of mutations and dangerous variants. And so we can't update our vaccines, we can't create new vaccines, and it will even affect our seasonal influenza vaccines, because every year we use WHO data to update our influenza vaccines.
Professor Gaston, in the same executive order in which Trump said the U.S. would be pulling out of the World Health Organization, he also called for the U.S. to stop negotiations on the WHO pandemic agreement, which some say is even more injurious to global public health than pulling U.S. funding from the WHO. If you could explain, what is this pandemic agreement?
I can. I don't think it's as bad as pulling out of the World Health Organization, but it is really bad. So in the aftermath of COVID, countries around the world called for a new pandemic treaty, because this pandemic agreement really would be a treaty, to try to make the world less vulnerable to the next pandemic. This would include, deep what we call one health approach, animals, climate, and humans, because, some 75% of all novel outbreaks arise in the animal community. It also includes equitable allocation of vaccines and treatments, and also rapid research and development for them, which is really very important. And then it has financing and other provisions for outbreak detection and response. The United States, for the last several years, has been kind of right at the head of the table. The Biden administration's been very constructive, and they've mediated between the Africa and equity groups and the European Union. We've been the honest broker in the room, and now we're walking away. And the irony is that what we're doing is we're allowing the global rules of the road without defending our national interests, our national values, and we cede leadership to our adversaries. I think one of the ironies of this whole thing is that President Trump has said that China has undue influence on WHO. Well, I've worked with WHO for nearly 40 years, and the U.S. has far more influence than China ever has. But that could change as we pull out of WHO and the pandemic agreement.
Professor Gostin, I wanted to ask you about other moves that President Trump has taken that have alarmed scientists and doctors around the country and the world. The Trump administration's abrupt cancellation of scientific meetings at the NIH and other places, as well as freezing many health agency reports and posts. What public health professionals around the country rely on to assess the health of the American people, including the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report of the Centers for Disease Control. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Oh, it's deeply consequential. I don't think people understand how consequential it is. Let me start with health communications. Having access to timely and accurate health messages from trusted public health agencies like the CDC and the FDA is really essential to Americans' public health. Absent that, we can't make good decisions about our health, our nutrition, whether there's a food outbreak, say of listeria, whether there's a warning about a novel circulating virus or a dangerous spike in COVID cases. These are things that the American people need to keep them healthy. And this will delay those things, and they will make them less true. Just ask yourself the question, who would you trust more to give you information about health than a career scientist at the CDC or the FDA, or a political appointee in the White House that filters scientific information through the lens of politics? It really is outrageous. I'm also a member of several of these scientific committees at NIH, and I can tell you, we're not there conspiring. We're there trying to figure out hard problems that affect the American population. You know, I know that a lot of President Trump's administration's, you know, kind of line is that these are, you know, fat bureaucrats. But I can tell you at NIH, CDC, FDA, these are doctors, scientists, nurses that get up every day and do their best to make America healthier and safer. They don't always get it right, but I would certainly trust their integrity, their experience, and their understanding of science to try to guide us through health emergencies and just everyday health problems that American families face.
Dr. Lawrence Gostin, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of global health law at Georgetown University, director of the WHO Collaborating Center on Public Health Law and Human Rights. We'll link to your Washington Post piece, Trump is withdrawing from the WHO. That's a grave mistake. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Again, the Trump administration freezing many health agency reports and posts until a political appointee is in place heading the Department of Health and Human Services. Trump's pick, the vaccine skeptic, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Coming up, as President Trump defends his sweeping pardons for January 6 insurrectionists, we'll speak with a young man who fears for his life after Trump pardoned his father. It was the son who tipped off the FBI about his father after the insurrection. Stay with us.
I'm taking back roads.
Half-Mast by Lucy Dacus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
President Trump is defending his decision to grant full, complete, and unconditional presidential pardons to over 1,500 of his supporters involved in the violent January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Trump also commuted the sentences of 14 members of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, including Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, who'd been convicted of seditious conspiracy. On Wednesday, Rhodes visited Capitol Hill to meet with Republican lawmakers after being released from prison. Critics of Trump's sweeping pardons include the Fraternal Order of Police, which had endorsed Trump in each of the last three elections. In a joint statement, the FOP and the International Association of Chiefs of Police said, quote, "When perpetrators of crimes, especially serious crimes, are not held fully accountable, it sends a dangerous message that the consequences for attacking law enforcement are not severe, potentially emboldening others to commit similar acts of violence." During an interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News, Trump defended the pardons.
And you know what they were there for? They were protesting the vote because they knew the election was rigged and they were protesting the vote. And that you should be allowed to protest a vote. You should be allowed to. You know, the day when the day comes,
but you shouldn't be able to invade the Capitol.
No, ready? Most of the people were absolutely innocent. Okay, but forgetting all about that, these people have served horribly a long time. It would be very, very cumbersome to go and look. You know how many people we're talking about? 1,500 people. Almost all of them are, should not have been, this should not have happened. And the other thing is this, some of those people with the police, true, but they were very minor incidents.
President Trump did the interview with Hannity in the Oval Office. Five police officers who served at the Capitol on January 6 died in the days and weeks after the attack. A total of 140 police officers were assaulted by Trump supporters that day. On Wednesday, former Washington, D.C. police officer Michael Fanone criticized the pardons for the rioters. Fanone suffered a heart attack and a traumatic brain injury after he was beaten and electrocuted with a taser while trying to defend the Capitol.
I made my way to the front line, and at one point, I was pulled off the police line by an individual. His name is Albuquerque Head. He's from Tennessee. He put me in a chokehold and pulled me out into the crowd. And if you watch my body-worn camera footage, you'll hear him yell out, "I've got one." Once I was out in the crowd, you know, I was beaten, restrained. At one point, an individual, Kyle Young, lunged at me while I was being restrained and attempted to remove my firearm from its holster. All while, you know, other individuals were, you know, kind of egging him on, telling him to kill me with my gun. Another individual, Daniel Rodriguez, used a taser device, applied it to my neck numerous times. And finally, Thomas Sibick stripped me of my badge and my radio, all while I was being, again, restrained and beaten. you know, these are the individuals that pled guilty and were sentenced. And Donald Trump saw it fit to pardon them.
That was former Washington, D.C. police officer Michael Fanon, who suffered a heart attack and a traumatic brain injury after he was beaten and electrocuted with a taser while trying to defend the Capitol. We're joined now by the son of one of the January 6th insurrectionists who was just pardoned. Jackson Reffitt's father, Guy Reffitt, was the first person to be convicted over January 6th. Guy Reffitt was a member of a far-right militia called the Texas Three Percenters. During his trial, jurors were shown video of Reffitt filming himself saying, "Drag those people out of the Capitol by their ankles. I just want to see Pelosi's head hit every effing stair on the way out, and leader Mitch McConnell, too."
It was Guy Reffitt's own son, Jackson, who tipped the FBI off about his dad after January 6th. Jackson Reffitt now fears for his life after Trump pardoned his father and 1,500 others involved in the insurrection. Jackson has already received numerous death threats. Jackson Reffitt joins us now from an undisclosed location. Hi, Jackson. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you talk about what your father did at the time, what you reported, and why you're so afraid right now?
Well, at the time, my father was really getting into all this, you know, 3% or militia movement following the events of 2020 leading into 2021. And that quickly escalated in 2020, bleeding into January 6th, you know, talking about what he's going to do. So I informed the FBI just to alleviate a lot of the paranoia and unknowingness that I had at that time. And I didn't realize it, but until January 5th, when he left, I did not know he committed to going to something like January 6th. And he was already on the way. And he then stormed up the Capitol steps with body armor, zip cuffs, and a handgun on his side, and came home clicking his heels in joy and validation over what had happened. And it was a terrifying moment in my life to think that that happened and happened to our family. It's unreal to even think about now.
So, Jackson, how do you understand why your father was drawn to these groups?
I understand it to be, you know, the fear-mongering that the Trump administration really put on these people. You know, I understand capitalism can atomize people and families and make them feel so alone and destroyed. But, you know, post-2016, my family really hit a huge crisis when the price of oil collapsed. My father lost his job from overseas. And when we hit back in America, I mean, we were picking up bed frames off the side of the road, you know, and sleeping on the same blow up mattress, you know, downloading movies from Netflix, bringing them home and watching them on the TV because we had no internet. And leading from the Trump administration from 2016 onwards, you know, my father really gripped onto what Trump was saying, really gathered what he was offering and trying to give to my family. Of course, you know, that only led to him running up the steps of the Capitol with a gun on his waist and years in prison. But, you know, I understand it to be that he was trying to defend my family and do what he thought was right. But, you know, that inevitably led to what it is now.
Well, and Jackson, but following this pardon, you said that, quote, "I can't imagine what he's going to be willing to do now. It could get a whole hell of a lot worse." Explain what you fear might happen.
So to look at how I'm feeling now, we have to look back post January 6, 2021, is my dad came home more proud than ever for doing something that a man who never knew he existed told him to do. And now he knows he exists. Donald Trump gave him that presidential pardon to validate and justify his actions. And the validation now, I'm sure, is swimming through the crowds of the people who participated in January 6th. Like, that is dangerous, you know, to justify actions like that and to completely validate them is going to be deadly, not only for me. My situation is explosive and some would call a dramatic, you know, visualization of what's going on in this country. But there are thousands and thousands of people who are just like me, who do not have the same privilege I do of being able to drop everything, move, buy a handgun. All this stuff is very lucky for me to have the opportunity to secure myself. Other people don't have that luxury, and I fear so much for them.
On Tuesday, former Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes spoke to reporters after his 18-year prison sentence was commuted by Trump. He went back to the scene of the crime, to the Capitol.
I feel vindicated and validated. Yes, absolutely. Of course, I haven't gotten a pardon yet. I got commutation. But I'm applying for one. I'm pretty positive I'll get one. When they review my case, they'll understand that I was targeted for who I am, not for anything I did.
So Stuart Rhodes' sentence was commuted. He's pushing for a full pardon. That means he can get guns. Jackson, if you could explain why you are so afraid of your dad. Do you fear your father pardoned, he can get weapons? We just showed a picture of him together with Stuart Rhodes. Do you fear he will go after you, that he will kill you? Has he ever threatened that?
Well, first off, I want to say that that's the first time I'm hearing that clip with Stuart Rhodes, and that's flabbergasting to hear. You know, I've been saying this stuff about validation and justification. That clip just, you know, dropped my stomach. That was terrifying to actually hear a member say that. But when it comes to my father, yes, of course, I'm terrified of all this stuff. I have nothing but paranoia and unknowingness about what's going to happen in the future, other than what I've heard and witnessed and seen my father and my mother get further and further radicalized throughout these years. I was ignorant when I was 18 when all this happened, to think that prison would distance himself from these militias. And his final testimony to the judge, he begged and pleaded that he was never going to participate in this far-right militia nonsense. But he's just been isolated and put into an echo chamber of these people that are going to validate and justify him. So I have no idea what my father is thinking right now. He can say whatever he wants, but his actions are the real thing that matter. And his actions have not shown any sort of growth. It is shown a further and further hole, a rabbit hole. You know, I love my father deeply, but this is not a healthy thing to dive into.
I want to bring another guest into this conversation to talk more about Trump's January 6th pardons. We're joined by former FBI Special Agent Mike German, who once worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups. He's a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. He has a new book out. It's called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Mike German is joining us from San Diego. Mike, welcome back to Democracy Now! As you listen to Jackson, and we look at who was on those steps and inside the Capitol, particularly the violent people, on the one hand, you have 140 officers who were injured. You have five who died in the days that followed, two by suicide, another after being gassed. You have the ones that were so seriously injured, like Fanone. And on the other side, you also had officers and sheriffs, a number of cops and military, even active duty, were in that crowd. Talk about your findings.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I think the pardons definitely send a message both to the far-right militant movement that political violence against Trump's enemies will be rewarded by the highest office in the land. And it also sends a message to law enforcement that there's no value in investigating and prosecuting far-right violence. Unfortunately, far-right violence has been something that law enforcement has rarely paid very much attention to. Even to this day, the FBI doesn't track the number of violent white supremacist attacks occur in this country or how many people are killed by those attacks. So this will reinforce what has been a blind spot for the FBI and generally for law enforcement. Obviously, there has been law enforcement support for these movements for some time. In fact, as an FBI agent, I received those warnings before I went undercover that, hey, you have to be careful who you talk to in law enforcement about these cases because there are sympathizers within law enforcement. And nobody on a joint terrorism task force thought that was an odd warning. And likewise, those warnings have been provided since, documented in a 2006 intelligence report and the 2015 FBI counterterrorism policy guide that warns agents investigating domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists that the subjects of their investigations often have active contacts with law enforcement. So this is a problem that's long been understood within law enforcement, but we don't have a national program designed to identify those officers and protect the public from them.
Mike German, so is that the explanation for why, as you said, that white supremacist violence is deprioritized by the FBI and other government agencies? The reason is that they are complicit. There are people within the FBI and these agencies that are complicit with white supremacists?
Not just that, but the white supremacy infects all of our institutions, and that includes prosecutors' offices, that includes judges, that includes corporate boards. Everywhere we see racial disparities that impact communities of color negatively and privilege white and male communities. So. It's not just the law enforcement officers. If we saw it on January 6th, there were a number of current and former law enforcement officers participating, but also current and former military people, members of state and local legislature. So this is a pervasive problem. But law enforcement is supposed to is designed to protect the American public. And here we see President Trump clearly sending the message that these institutions designed to protect the American public are instead going to be used to protect his supporters and target his enemies.
So what's your reading, Mike German, of what the effect of these pardons will be, not just on white supremacist violence, but violence in general, political violence in the U.S.?
And that's really the big problem is that it's totally unpredictable. You know, once the highest office in the land gives a green light to political violence, it's very hard to predict who is ultimately going to be harmed. And, you know, if you look at some of these recent attacks, including the attempted assassination of President Trump, these are people who are, according to the government's intelligence that they've released, people who have been immersed in these conspiracy theories that Jackson was talking about. And it's all, even when I was in the movement, it was very hard to predict how any one piece of news would be interpreted in this group that has a very different sense of reality than the general public. So it will be very disruptive within the far right militant movement as well, because these people who went to prison are now coming out, but others have rebuilt these organizations in their own image, and it's going to be a very difficult period, I'm afraid.
I wanted to end with Jackson. Jackson, you're in an undisclosed location now. Your mother and sisters sided with your father. Only you and your boyfriend know exactly where you are. Your boyfriend, transgender, on his first day back in office, President Trump also moved to roll back protections for the transgender community. Do you think that LGBTQ and transgender issues also drives your father in your fear of what he could do to you?
I don't know anymore. It's been 4 years, leading up, and when as he spiraled in 2020, it got worse and worse with his, you know, hate towards LGBTQ and queer adjacent people. But, you know, seeing my own mother not be able to handle it, as she also delved into this far right agenda that she pandered to and fed into, I can't imagine how far my father has gotten. I'm terrified to even confront him about it because I don't know anymore and I don't want to be hurt like that. I can handle, you know, their frustrations and their anger and how sad they are with me. I want to be there with them with that. I want to be able to work with them on that. But for something like that, with my wonderful partner, my boyfriend, I that is so hard to compromise with. You know, I can handle everything else. I can figure stuff out. I can distance. I can be safe. I have all those options, but when it comes to something like that, that bigoted behavior and language that terrifies me. And as it's gotten worse throughout the years, I have no idea where it lays now. And with something like that, I don't know how to manage.
Well, Jackson, I want to thank you for being with us. You're very brave to speak out from where you are. Jackson Reffitt, his father, Guy Reffitt, just pardoned by Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection. And Mike, thank you so much. We hope to have you back on soon to talk more about your book and your findings. Former FBI special agent, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. Mike Brennan's new book is called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Coming up, a ceasefire's largely holding in Gaza, but Israel's intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank. Back in 20 seconds. وهي ما بدها خاتم ولا بهواها خاتم بدها عالم فلسطيني رفرف على المحاكم هي ما بدها هدية ولا بهواها هدية بدها عالم فلسطيني رفرف على المسكوبية وأنا ما بدي حطة ولا بهواي حطة بدي عالم فلسطيني رفرف عسيج شرطة أنا ما بدي زفة ولا بهواي زفة بدي تبطل فلسطين محصورة بأرض الضفة وهي ما بدها ذهب ولا بهواها ذهب بدها عالم فلسطين
زفت أطخرير Liberation Chant by Kalkim. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
While a ceasefire is largely holding in Gaza, Israel is intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military has killed at least 13 people in a major military operation targeting Jenin that began on Tuesday when Israeli troops raided the city backed by airstrikes, drones and Apache helicopters. Meanwhile, Israeli settler groups have carried out a new wave of attacks against Palestinians. On his first day in office, Trump rescinded sanctions imposed by President Biden on far-right Israeli settler groups. This is Jalal Bashir, head of the village council of Jina Safut.
Yesterday, we heard Trump's statement that he would reverse sanctions against settlers that assault Palestinians, along with Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's release of arrested settlers. This all encourages violence and gives momentum to these attacks on our village.
Joining us now is Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Her new piece for Dropsite News headlined Israel invades Jenin days after signing Gaza ceasefire. Talk about that, Mariam, this connection between the ceasefire in Gaza and the intensified attacks on the West Bank and the number of people who've been killed, the role, and particularly if you can talk about doctors and hospitals being targeted.
All right. Thank you, Amy. So what we're seeing right now is an operation dubbed Operation Iron Wall, waged by the Israeli government against the West Bank, specifically targeting Jenin and Jenin refugee camp that is north of the West Bank. And what we have seen in the last 72 hours is 13 Palestinians at least have been killed. Of them is a 16-year-old boy. Now, while the Israeli military spokesperson claims that they have targeted and eliminated 13 terrorists, it is important to recollect and realize that most were civilians that were killed, including a young 16-year-old boy, including a father who was killed in front of his son. And we're seeing reports of field executions. But in fact, we actually don't know the real number of those killed or injured because the Israeli military is denying access to medical personnel inside the camp. So we're seeing Israel wage a war that very much resembles the practices they have committed in Gaza, according to colleagues on the ground. They're comparing it to what Israel did in Jabalia, north of Gaza, including the field executions, including the displacement of families at gunpoint, forcing them to escape their homes and creating a corridor, a humanitarian corridor from the camp to the outside of the camp for families to leave, giving them until the end of today or else. And this is what the soldiers would tell families, leave or else.
Mariam, could you talk about the impact of the fact that on his first day in office, President Trump lifted Biden-era sanctions against Israeli settlers accused of violence against Palestinians. It was on that day itself that Israeli settlers stormed several villages in the occupied West Bank. If you could respond to that decision by Trump and what impact it's had on the ground.
Of course, what we're seeing with Trump's swearing in the day after is an emboldened Israeli regime. And let's remember that in his last term, President Trump had declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which further pushed settlers to basically rampage through Jerusalem and the West Bank at unprecedented levels of violence against Palestinians. So what we're seeing from the Palestinian end in regards to Trump's inauguration again is a fear that settlers are going to even feel more emboldened, especially in light of the impunity that Israel has despite the genocide it has committed in Gaza. Because as of now, we haven't seen any real accountability measures against war criminals, Israeli war criminals. So Palestinians are frightened, while on the other hand, we're seeing settlers celebrate President Trump. In fact, in the E1 area near Jerusalem, settlers are calling for the renaming of some settlement blocks in honor of Trump as Trump blocks. So where we're seeing the discrepancy here and disparity and the likely violence that may erupt in the coming weeks and months.
I wanted to ask the effect of the Trump presidency right now and how it is affecting what's going on there. You have the choice to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, former Congress member Lee Stefanik, refusing to say Tuesday whether the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. She made her comments while she was being questioned by the Senate Foreign Relations, Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, who said she said that Israel has a biblical right to dominion over the occupied West Bank. So we're talking about annexation of the West Bank. What does that mean, Mariam, for the people of the West Bank?
It means more displacement. It means pushing Palestinian families out of their lands. And we're seeing this increase. The level of outposts being erected in the last 15 months has been unprecedented. And at the same time, primarily the American government, in support, with support from Europe as well and Canada, they have left the Palestinians completely defenseless. Palestinians are not allowed to have an army. Palestinians are not allowed to confront Israeli soldiers that are invading their homes. Now, we must remember that the Israeli military is carrying out an offensive on Jenin, which is in the West Bank, which Israeli presence is deemed illegal under international law, and the UN has voted as Israel being illegally present in the West Bank and Gaza. So what that means is more violence, but also it's sinister in that the continued arming of Israel with D9 bulldozers, with Blue 109 bombs, and then the stripping of Palestinians, not just of the right to self-determination, but any capacity to survive. Things like not condemning the cutting off of water from families or electricity or denying the medical capacity and access. It's a very slow slaughter of Palestinians. So if you survive a bullet, you don't know if you're going to survive daily life.
And Mariam, could you also talk about, you've written about this, the fact that this Operation Iron Wall coincides with the longest and most lethal campaign by the Palestinian Authority also on Jenin.
Yes. So what we're seeing in this operation, which the Israeli military released a statement today saying it is the most advanced operation of its kind in the region and in the area. What we are seeing is direct coordination and collaboration with the Palestinian Authority, which has arrested journalists in the past few days who have covered Jenin, and they have arrested resistance fighters, and we have heard reports of them facing torture at the hands of the Palestinian Authority. Now, it's really important to recognize that Operation Iron Wall comes just a day after the Palestinian Authority allegedly ended its six-week-long siege on Jenin refugee camp, where they cut electricity from families, where they denied them access to medical care and even targeted medics in a similar fashion to Israel. So what we're really seeing is a proxy army for Israel and the Israeli army really targeting Palestinians in the West Bank right now who have no one protecting them, essentially, other than the small groups of resistance fighters who are realistically no match to the power and technology that Israel has and the coordination with the Palestinian Authority.
Marianne Barghouti, do you think Israel is using the siege on Jenin to indirectly break the ceasefire deal? And-